Well, strictly speaking, Darwinism is biological evolution. That is to say that Darwinists believe that life arose by chance, acted over millions of years by natural selection to produce the life that we see on Earth today. But by extension, it's been applied to other fields too. Chemical evolution, cultural evolution, social Darwinism has broadened its application. And because it says there's no need for a creator, then it implies atheism and secular humanism. Well, today we live in a world that's sharply divided over issues such as gay rights, abortion, the role of religion in the public place, and creation versus evolution. In fact, we've become so divided that some philosophers and psychologists look at biblical creationism as some sort of mental disorder. One evolutionist says fundamentalist religion, and I think he included biblical Christianity in that category. He says fundamentalist religion is one of the unmitigated evils of this world. Richard Dawkins, an outspoken anti-creationist, recently said that Christian education has been deeply damaging to generations of innocent school children. He goes on to say, innocent children are being saddled with demonstrable falsehoods. It's time to question the abuse of childhood innocence with superstitious ideas of hellfire and damnation. So you see, he's equating teaching biblical ideas with child abuse. In fact, in 1981, there was a resolution by the National Academy of Sciences which said, religion and science are separate and mutually exclusive realms of thought whose presentation in the same context leads to misunderstanding of both scientific and religious belief. So I guess we can't have both, at least not in the same context. So in the public arena, the debate comes off like this. Evolution is science. Creation, religion. So what they're saying is evolution is based upon cold, hard, objective, undisputable facts of science, whereas creation, that's just superstition. That's unprovable beliefs. And so evolution comes out on top in the public arena. But I say that's not necessarily the case. That true science and creation are compatible. True science and Christianity are compatible. But it depends on definitions. The problem is that in recent years, science has been redefined. In fact, the basis of modern science is now materialism and naturalism. Well, what's materialism? Materialism is the view that the material world is all there is. There's no existence beyond this present life. They go on to say that only physical forces are real, things that we can measure like gravity and electromagnetism. In fact, they say whatever can't be measured is just a product of human imagination. And then they go on to say that life is just a special form of physical energy, of movement of matter. In other words, life is just chemistry. We're just a pile of chemical reactions, and that's all there is to it. Science today is also defined in terms of naturalism. Naturalism says that Everything can be explained by natural causes. We don't need to invoke anything supernatural, especially when it comes to the origin of the universe and of nature. And they say all knowledge is empirical. That is to say, all knowledge that we know is based on observation and experience. And they say that there is, nor has there ever been, any supernatural intervention in the universe. Therefore, science is the only reliable path to knowledge. Creation is therefore unscientific and unworthy of serious consideration, especially in the scientific journals. Richard Lewontin goes on to say, "We scientists have a prior commitment to materialism, and we are forced by our a priori adherence to material causes to create an apparatus of investigation and a set of concepts that produce material explanations. Moreover, that materialism is absolute, for we cannot allow a divine foot in the door." So you see what he's saying? Materialism is everything. God cannot be, by definition, allowed into the picture. So at heart, what we have here is a clash of worldviews. They claim that it's faith versus science. In fact, I saw an article in the paper just last week, faith versus science. But as I'm going to show tonight, the battle is really faith versus humanism, faith versus atheism. So we see a fundamental clash of worldviews. What's a worldview? A worldview is the way we view the world around us. The two basic positions are either it's man-centered or it's God-centered. Unfortunately, both evolution and Christianity are unalterably opposed when you get right down to it. Some people would try to compromise it, but in so doing, you come up with just sort of a mishmash, a watered-down Christianity that really doesn't work. In fact, even evolutionists recognize the conflict. Michael Ruth says, "Either humankind is in a state of original sin, or it's not. If it is, there was reason for Jesus to die on the cross. If it's not, Calvary has as much relevance as a gladiator's death in the Colosseum." Well, by totally excluding God from their thinking, reminds me of Romans 1:22. "Although they claim to be wise, they became fools." Well, my question for tonight that I'd like to investigate is, how did we ever get to this state of affairs? If we look back to Darwin's time, most people think of Darwin as the father of evolution, but actually, it turns out that we have to go back farther to find the roots of the conflict. I began to wonder what was going on when I read that Darwin's Origin of Species, published in 1859, was an immediate success. It sold out all 1,250 copies on the first day of publication. Now, 1,250 copies, by today's standards, that doesn't sound like a lot, but actually, it was quite a bit for his day. In fact, it went through a total of 6 editions, each of which generated more sales. But it was as if the world had been eagerly anticipating some way to put man in the driver's seat, to free themselves from having God set the rules. So what I'd like to do is look at some of the ideas that preceded Darwin and led up to the acceptance of his theory of evolution. Now, to do that, we have to go back to the time of the Renaissance. Renaissance means new birth and it meant a new birth of learning. Generally, a revival of classic Greek and Roman learning and art and so forth. And along with it, a rejection of Middle Age attitudes and ideas. But the Renaissance actually could be thought of as being composed of two streams of thought. On the one hand, we have biblical Christianity, which reawakened at that time and led to the Reformation. And before I go on, I'd like to point out just what was going on with the Reformation. I don't intend to spend a lot of time on that, but just to give sort of a balance, we might consider some of the people that contributed, some of the most famous ones. Martin Luther, of course, in Germany, who nailed his 95 theses to the door of the church in Wittenberg in 1517. John Wycliffe, the morning star of the Reformation. John Huss in Germany, Savonarola, Italy. Zwingli and Calvin in Switzerland. John Knox in Scotland. These were some of the thinkers that were contributing to the Reformation. But then, going back to the other side, there was a humanistic side to the Renaissance, often called the Age of Rationalism or the Age of Reason. The Age of Reason was probably the most significant stream of thought of the Renaissance. In fact, most Renaissance philosophers believed that society could civilize people and steer them away from evil. Not the Bible, not any kind of religion, but just being together in society. The emphasis of the Age of Reason was on humanity rather than God. They viewed ancient Greece and Rome as models to be followed in building society. In fact, this kind of thinking even affected a lot of Christian thinkers such as Augustine. Well, going back to the basis of the Reformation, we see it was a rebirth of learning leading to the Reformation. But it also, in addition to the reformers in the church, produced a number of Christian scientists. In fact, most scientists of the time, most post-medieval scientists, were believers. They believed in the inspiration of Scripture, and they based their science upon that belief. They believed in an orderly God, a God that created an orderly universe, that created laws that could be discovered. And so, science became founded upon biblical concepts. Just to name a few of some of the most outstanding scientists of the time, who were all Christians, Lord Kelvin, a physicist and mathematician who precisely defined the first and second laws of thermodynamics. Louis Pasteur, one of the greatest biologists who debunked the theory of spontaneous generation of life, among other things. Robert Boyle, the father of modern chemistry. James Clerk Maxwell, one of the most learned scientist, one of the greatest scientists of all time, who did a lot in electromagnetics. Isaac Newton, of course, with his formulation of the law of gravity, the laws of motion, helped to develop calculus. Gregor Mendel, the father of modern genetics. Michael Faraday invented the electric generator, among other things. Georges Cuvier, founder of modern anatomy and paleontology, Matthew Maury, who took his inspiration from a scripture to discover the ocean currents, Blaise Pascal, inventor of the barometer, Joule, discoverer of the mechanical equivalent of heat, the Vinci. I put up hydraulics there, but of course he was much more. He did a lot in aerodynamics. He was an engineer, an architect, an artist. Francis Bacon gave us the modern scientific method. Johann Kepler discovered the laws of planetary motion and endeavored to think God's thoughts after him. So you see, all these early scientists were dedicated to discovering the laws that God created, the principles of God. But then we come to a man named William of Ockham. And you may have heard of Ockham's razor, which says that basically the simplest explanation for a phenomenon is most likely the correct one. Well, Ockham said that there should be a division between science and theology. He drew a sharp line between natural knowledge, that is science, and revealed truth, that is theology. Now, previously, the two realms had been blended together, but he said, no, they should be separate. Well, nobody did much with his writings for a couple hundred years until we come to, well, here's the split just shown on the diagram there, until we come to the age of rationalism beginning in the 17th century. Now, most rationalists were deists. A deist is someone who believes that there's a God, but he's somewhere off doing something else after long ago doing the creation. Some rationalists were actually atheists. Well, anyway, I'm showing here René Descartes, a famous French mathematician who gave us many of the mathematical concepts that we use today, such as the Cartesian coordinate system. He constructed a mathematical view of the universe, a rational view, in which the truths of mathematics were created by a good and infinite God. And he said that everything can be explained by mathematical laws. However, on the other hand, he said it's not really possible to be certain of anything because our senses may be deceived. Now, he wrote that to exercise good reason or to become rational only takes education that teaches critical thinking. Does that sound familiar? It should. That's what the educational establishment is talking about today. Just give the kids lots of education, develop critical thinking, and everything will be okay. That's what they say. And on the other hand, they're teaching the dogma of evolution. Well, rationalists believe that the world consisted of two basic substances, spirit and matter. And that sort of accentuated the split between faith and science. The next writer that I'd like to consider, who is also an important contributor to the Age of Reason, was Jean-Jacques Rousseau. Now, Rousseau said that progress in the arts and sciences actually contributed to the corruption of society and of people. And people would be better off living out in the natural, isolated, away from the corrupting influences of society. Now, virtually all philosophers of the Age of Reason believed in the superiority of reason and knowledge. The slogan became, "Knowledge is power." They magnified reason versus ignorance, superstition, and uncritical acceptance of authority. This was kind of a backlash against the dogmatism of the Roman Catholic Church during medieval times, but he wanted to throw out the whole thing. So this became the age of the worship of reason. The human ability to reason was elevated above all other means for finding the truth. They said that only reason can yield universal truths. We're born with the ability to distinguish right from wrong. And so we don't need the Bible or anything else to tell us right and wrong, but reason itself will get us there. There were other rationalists of the age that I won't talk about, but one was Voltaire, who was an atheist. Well, along with rationalism came materialism about the same time, typified by Thomas Hobbes, who was apparently a deist. Materialism was sort of a revival of an earlier Greek concept called atomism, in which they believed that everything consisted of atoms, mind and matter both. But he said that all is material or matter, and everything can be explained by scientific laws. In fact, he thought that beliefs, thoughts, sensations, emotions were all properties of material systems. In other words, just chemical reactions. That's all we are, just chemistry. Further, he said that humans don't have a spiritual nature. Well, after a while, this kind of thinking began to start weakening the biblical basis of science. It was still there, but here comes this other stream of thought competing with that. Another stream of thought that I'd like to examine was called empiricism. David Hume of England was a good example. He said that experience is the most important source of knowledge. In fact, he denied anything that we can't sense with our five senses. And so he said, because of that, we can't base our decisions on other sources such as the Bible or governmental authority. It reminds me of that bumper sticker you used to see, question authority. So once again, empiricism comes along saying experience is the most important source of knowledge. The biblical basis for science is beginning to erode. Well, along with empiricism, toward the 18th century, the Renaissance took on a new tone. They called it the Enlightenment. The Enlightenment was supposed to be an emancipation from superstition and prejudices of earlier times. Again, hearkening back to the medieval Catholic Church. Their goal, the goal of the Enlightenment, was the achievement of concordance with fact and reason. In other words, they wanted to become, just like Mr. Spock, totally logical and reasonable. And they were starting to look for new theories to explain heaven and earth. And along with this came the beginning of the rejection of the biblical explanations. They believed that once people became enlightened, our society's problems would be solved. Well, here then we have the stage set for Hutton and Lyell to come along. They came up with the doctrine of uniformitarianism. Now, uniformitarianism says that all geologic processes took vast amounts of time. The present is the key to the past. In other words, what we see going on, geologically speaking, around us today is what has always happened. And therefore, there was no Genesis flood. It wasn't the flood that shaped the geologic features that we see today, but slow, gradual geologic processes that took eons of time. This was just what Well, let me back up a second. Uniformitarianism, the saying that there is no flood, further weakening the biblical basis of science. But as I started to say, this set the stage for Charles Darwin, because Darwin needed lots of time for evolution to take place. As a matter of fact, in Darwin's voyage on the Beagle in the 1830s, he took with him Lyell's book on principles of geology, and he became thoroughly enamored with them. And during that voyage, he gradually began to throw away his biblical beliefs and subscribe to Lyell's beliefs in long ages. So Darwin then said that all plant and animal life evolved gradually from a few common ancestors, acted upon by natural selection. That's what produced evolution. And of course, requiring vast amounts of time. Now, after the voyage on the Beagle, Darwin became a pupil of Lyell's. He studied under him for a few years, and then they became close friends. And finally, it was Lyell that urged Darwin to publish his Origin of Species in 1859. And so we've come full circle with Darwinism saying there's no need for a creator, there's no flood. Science has now gotten to the point where it's based on evolution. Oh, there were people that cried out against it, but as the time went on, their voices grew more silent until today science is dominated by evolution. Well, there are a couple of other things to add to the mixture here. One is naturalism. Now, naturalism started in the 1890s, and what it is scientific theory applied to imaginative writing. It was influenced by both Darwinism and empiricism, and it said, like empiricism, that knowledge is acquired only through the senses. But they went on to say that everything that people do is determined by heredity or the environment. In other words, we're not responsible for our actions. It's all society's fault. It's all the environment. It's all genes, you know. So that sort of takes the responsibility before God away from us. Naturalism liked to emphasize the physical world and exclude the supernatural. One popular writer of naturalism was Jack London. You've probably seen the movie or perhaps read the books, The Call of the Wild or White Fang, were a couple of his most popular novels. London was very much an evolutionist, a socialist. If you read the books, or let me go back, if you see the movies, you don't pick up on the theme of evolution so much. It looks like just an interesting adventure story. But if you read his books, you can see very much the struggle for existence, the survival of the fittest theme. In fact, he was the one that popularized the phrase red tooth and claw. Other writers of that period were Stephen Crane, who wrote The Red Badge of Courage, and Frank Norris, who wrote The Octopus and other books. But the thing about these novels was that they were characterized by brutal realism and pessimism. The Call of the Wild, to me, seemed to be very dark and pessimistic. Well, this thinking has carried forward into today's entertainment world. In movies, they call it neorealism. Well, scientific naturalism says that all things can be explained by natural causes and scientific laws. This has been a significant influence in mainstream thought since the 1890s. Naturalists say if God exists, he either couldn't or wouldn't break his natural laws, therefore no supernatural events have ever happened. In other words, there's no such thing as miracles. Naturalism says that only its explanations are scientific, and therefore it's the only acceptable worldview. Those who oppose it are labeled unscientific and anti-intellectual. Well, going back a little bit, I'd like to add one further stream of thought to our discussion, and that is what was known as Romanticism. Romanticism was kind of opposed to rationalism because it emphasized feeling over reason, and yet the effects of rationalism still lingered. So we have kind of a mixture of thought going on there. Feeling, though, became more important than anything else. Individuality and impulse were preferred over that stuffy old self-discipline, you know. And individual rights came to the forefront. Nature began to be viewed as being living. In other words, it was sort of like pantheism. Pantheism says that God is everything. The earth is God, the sky is God, we're God, etc., etc. Well, does this sound familiar? Well, it should. That was the hallmark of the hippie movement of the 1960s and 70s. And the New Agers still believe most of this stuff, even today. Well, Edgar Allan Poe was a romanticist. Others were Nathaniel Hawthorne and James Fenimore Cooper. If you've ever read any of Cooper's stuff, you may remember him talking about the noble savage. What was the noble savage? Well, the one who has separated himself from society, like the unspoiled Indians. See, it was our science and technology that corrupted the Indians, and they were much better off back in the wilderness living by themselves. It harkens really back to Rousseau and his rationalism. Well, according to evolutionary theory, whatever you are is good, whatever you do is right. The result, moral relativism, which says that there are no absolutes. In fact, moral relativism says there's no such thing as immorality. Or they change the definition to say it's immoral to restrict the behavior of anyone. It's been argued that moral relativism must be true because, after all, Darwinism is true, right? I don't think so. Well, moral relativism has been typified by spokesmen such as the French philosopher Jean-Paul Sartre, who was an existentialist. Existentialism basically denies the existence of any and all absolute truth. They say that truth is relative. There are no absolutes. I wonder if they're absolutely sure. Well, they say that each person operates by his or her own moral code. What's right for one person isn't necessarily right for another. Well, if you ask people, you won't find too many people who claim to be existentialists. In fact, probably most people don't know the meaning of the word. And yet, that philosophy has absolutely saturated our society. I'm sure most of you have heard this at one time or another. Well, that might be okay for you, but not for me. I operate by my own principles. I know I've run into it. It kind of, it goes back actually to Charles Darwin again. In his autobiography, he said, "A man who has no assured and ever-present belief in the existence of a personal God or of a future existence with retribution and reward can have for his rule of life, as far as I can see, only to follow those impulses and instincts which are the strongest or which seem to him the best ones." In other words, he's the moral relativist of his time. He's saying, do whatever seems right. There's nothing that's absolutely true. No absolute right or wrong. Reminds me of the days of the judges. In those days, there was no king in Israel. Everyone did what was right in his own times. And that was a rather unstable period in Israel's history. Now, evolution says there is no personal God. Without God, evolution has become preeminent in today's thinking. In fact, evolution is the worldview encompassing all major areas of human thought, it seems. It's a supreme overriding point of view adopted by the intellectual elite. There's a theologian who is actually a theistic evolutionist by the name of Teilhard de Chardin. He said, is evolution a theory, a system, or a hypothesis? It's much more. Evolution is a light illuminating all facts, a trajectory that all lines of thought must follow. So it seems that survival of the fittest, or the struggle for existence, has become more entrenched in popular thought today than the golden rule. Why is the left so committed to evolution and regardless of the evidence? Well, it's because they want a man-centered universe instead of a God-centered universe. They want man to be the authority so they can do whatever they want, basically, instead of having to follow a bunch of stuffy rules. Let's see what some modern spokesmen are saying and have said. Carl Sagan was the host of the popular Nova series on TV for a number of years. He was an astronomer, an atheist. He said, the cosmos, the physical universe, is all that is, or ever was, or ever will be. He wrote a book called A Pale Blue Dot, referring to what Earth looks like from a long distance in space. He said, our planet is a lonely speck in the great enveloping cosmic dark. In our obscurity, in all this vastness, there's no hint help will come from elsewhere to save us from ourselves. What a pessimist. Isaac Asimov, an atheist, science fiction writer, helped popularize science, admitted, I'm an atheist out and out. I do not have the evidence to prove that God does not exist, but I so strongly suspect that he does not, that I do not want to waste my time. Well, I suspect he has plenty of time to waste now. He wrote a book called Asimov's Book of Science and Nature Quotations, and in that book he quotes someone by the name of Clara Lucas Balfour. She said, mankind struggles upwards, in which millions are trampled to death that thousands may mount on their bodies. Isn't that a cheery thought? But that's what evolution says. Stephen Jay Gould, late professor of paleontology at Harvard, who co-authored the punctuated equilibrium theory to try to explain the gaps in the fossil record, said, well, evolution is a theory. It's also a fact. How many have seen books that say evolution's a fact? I know I have. It's a fact. Just believe it. I don't think so. And then there's Richard Dawkins, one of the most caustic anti-creationist, anti-Christian speakers around today. He says, it's absolutely safe to say that if you meet somebody who claims not to believe in evolution, that person is ignorant, stupid, or insane. Well, I've been trying to figure out which category I fit into. Maybe, I don't know, I guess the ignorant one's as good as any. And then there's Michael Ruse. I'm sorry to be so rude about this. Not that sorry. I really want to believe. I find the goodies offered by Christianity extremely attractive. But I'm blanked again if I'm going to sell my evolutionary birthright for a mess of religious pottage. You can see in that statement his Christian upbringing, because he alluded to Genesis chapter 25, talking about Esau, who gave up his inheritance for a mess of pottage. But he is talking about an evolutionary birthright, and I'm still trying to figure out what that entails. What is he going to get out of evolution? I don't know. It kind of reminds me of Isaiah 5:20, which says, "Woe to those who call evil good and good evil, who put darkness for light and light for darkness, who put bitter for sweet and sweet for bitter." What I'd like to do for the rest of this presentation is talk about the fallout of all of this thinking on our culture. You know, they say that ideas have consequences. And several hundred years of rationalism, materialism, Darwinism is bound to affect us. And indeed, it has. I'd like to start off with the church. Now, I'm not going to be able to talk about every effect on society, or we'd be here all night. But let me just pick out a few that I think are significant. It turns out that many churches, denominations, and even Christian colleges have accepted some form of evolution. In fact, the abandonment of Scripture as final authority is the result of accepting evolution. Because if we can throw out Genesis, that opens the door to the rest of it. You know that there are creation verses in most of the books of the Bible, so that immediately makes the rest of them, as well as a lot of things that Jesus said, open to question. So they've replaced theistic evolution with biblical creationism. And then, how can they believe what Jesus said? Was he really from God, or was he just a prophet? Is he really divine? The focus then becomes on social justice rather than on sin. Sin becomes unfashionable, outmoded, and actually it goes back to Genesis. But if you throw away Genesis, then sin goes along with it. Then you lose, along with it, other foundational doctrines such as the virgin birth, the resurrection, and so forth. So the result has been to water down the authority of the church. We wonder why the mainline denominations are losing so many members. Could this be part of it? The result of all this, then, is that a subtle form of moral relativism has crept into our thinking. Yeah, even into the thinking of the church. In fact, according to a recent survey by George Barna, the Christian pollster, he reports that 91.5% of teenagers in church believe in moral relativism. They don't believe the Bible is absolutely true. In fact, there was a survey done by Ken Ham and Henry Morris, who they report that most Christian colleges have adopted some compromise with evolution, such as theistic evolution. A survey by ICR says that only 29% of 649 Christian colleges surveyed reported that they teach biblical creationism. Well, let's look at another fallout on our culture, and that is the devaluation of life, which is kind of giving us a culture of death, manifesting itself in abortion, euthanasia, and even eugenics. When I think of this, I think of the kids I see out in the street. I'm sure many of you have seen the t-shirts that a lot of them are wearing these days with the skull and the knives dripping with blood and this kind of thing. Unfortunately, that's become all too commonplace. Let's consider how evolution has affected abortion. We need to go back to the late 19th century and a German zoologist by the name of Ernst Haeckel. He came up with the theory of embryonic recapitulation, or the gill slit theory. Now, what he said was that in studying human embryos and other embryos, he studied all kinds of them, he noticed structures that looked like gill slits in the developing human embryo. And from this, he claimed that man had evolved from fish, that these were actually gills. And he went on to say that during development of the embryo in the womb, it goes through all the stages of evolution in coming to its final form. This became known as the fundamental law of biology, according to Haeckel. And the slogan was ontogeny recapitulates phylogeny. That is to say, the embryo goes through all stages of evolution during its development before birth. Here are the drawings that Haeckel produced. He produced a number of these, but this is a sample of ones that appeared in textbooks for nearly 100 years. Along the top row are the early stages of development of a fish, salamander, tortoise, and so forth, all over on the right-hand side, a human. Notice that they look very similar. So he was trying to show that we all have evolutionary common roots. The only problem was these drawings were faked. If you ever see actual photos of embryos, they're completely different, very different, especially along that top row there. Now, he was exposed by his peers as early as 1874. His drawings were shown to be completely fraudulent, and yet they seem to have captured the imagination of generations of textbook writers because they were endlessly published and republished in school textbooks for years and years, and you may still occasionally see them. In fact, Haeckel's so-called law has been used as justification for abortion. Because after all, if the human fetus is going through the fish stage and the amphibian stage and all this kind of stuff before it becomes fully human, then aborting it isn't murder. It's just getting rid of the lower stages of evolution. And so, no problem, right? Well, that's what a lot of people have believed. In fact, Haeckel himself promoted infanticide in a book that he wrote called The Natural History of Creation. Well, in spite of the fraudulence of his claims, Haeckel's theory captivated the mind of many people, including Margaret Sanger. Margaret Sanger was a feminist, the founder of Planned Parenthood. She was very much influenced by Haeckel, and she assumed the evolutionary process of man, so she said, and proposed to help the process of survival of the fittest by birth control. According to her, birth control was nothing more nor less than the facilitation of weeding out the unfit. So she proposed to help evolution out by birth control. In fact, today, a lot of abortionists consider terminating a pregnancy just like sort of getting rid of a disease. Let's consider something else, euthanasia. Euthanasia means easy death. It's legal in some countries, and I guess in Oregon now. It's promoted as death with dignity. One of the guys who really has promoted this is Dr. Jack Kevorkian, otherwise known as Dr. Death. Well, he's currently doing 10 to 25 in a Michigan prison for homicide, but he helped I don't know how many people to their deaths. But euthanasia can be justified on the grounds of moral relativism. After all, what's right for me may not be right for you, and so what I do is okay, you can't judge it. The subtle undertone here is that euthanasia actually benefits evolution, benefits the human race by not burdening down the fittest to care for those that are not fit. So the rationale is if a person isn't contributing to the good of humanity, then ending their lives is a benefit to the overall evolutionary progress of society. Well, to some people that sounds good, but where is it going to lead? Eugenics is an offshoot of Darwinism. It's eliminating the unfit members of society, the poor, the elderly, the infirm, mentally retarded, and the so-called inferior races. You may not know that the subtitle of Darwin's book on the Origin of Species was The Preservation of Favored Races in the Struggle for Life. Darwin was very much a racist. And of course, he considered himself at the top of the evolutionary ladder. And the 19th century evolutionists considered people like the Tasmanian Aborigines at the bottom. They were more or less equivalent to Neanderthals, according to some of them. Well, the word eugenics was coined by Darwin's cousin, Francis Galton. Galton was an admirer of Darwin. The word eugenics means noble in heredity or good in birth. He said that his goal was to improve the human race by giving the more suitable races or strains of blood a better chance of prevailing speedily over the less suitable. Well, most evolutionists distance themselves from eugenics today because of the horrible experiments performed by the Germans in World War II in the name of eugenics. They claim that, well, those guys, they distorted Darwinism, but yet it's a legacy of that belief. Well, here's another one maybe you thought of, maybe you haven't, but animal rights and evolution. According to Darwin, in his book called The Descent of Man, he said, there's no fundamental difference between man and the higher mammals in their mental faculties. The difference in mind between man and the higher animals, great as it is, certainly is one of degree and not of kind. Well, if, according to Darwin, we're not created in the image of God, then man doesn't have any special status, but we're just a little bit higher on the evolutionary ladder than animals. And therefore, animals should have many of the same legal protection as humans do, especially those that they deem higher on the evolutionary ladder and closer to us, like apes and chimps and so forth. So animal rights advocates today are pushing for legal rights for the higher animals, including legal personhood for animals such as the primates. One spokesman says that apes should have at least the same legal protections as those given to children and to other people unable to speak for themselves. Well, animal rights advocates say that they should have the right to have lawsuits filed in their behalf. Just what we need, more lawsuits, right? They should have compensatory damages for medical expenses. They should even have provision for a comfortable retirement. Well, don't tell my dog, but he's really very comfortable in his retirement. Not only that, they should have certain constitutional rights, such as the Eighth Amendment, which prohibits cruel and unusual punishment. and the 13th Amendment prohibiting slavery. Here's a quote that tells you where they're coming from. Stephen M. Wise says, "The universe is not designed at all, much less designed for humans." Well, how about the outlook on life? Darwinism is very pessimistic because it says life has no meaning, no purpose. And man is just an accident in space. We are just the product of random chance circumstances. And so, this produces an air of hopelessness, of depression, suicide. We wonder why there's a problem with teen suicide. Well, if we came from nowhere and we're going nowhere, then what's the use? What's there to live for? There's no meaning in life. If life has no meaning, then maybe drugs or alcohol would help us find some kind of a meaning. At least that's the way that some people think, and that's perhaps why some turn to drugs, is to find sort of a substitute religion. Michael Denton, the author of Evolution, A Theory in Crisis, said, "It was because Darwinian theory broke man's link with God and set him adrift in a cosmos without purpose or end that its impact was so fundamental." And how right he was. Well, there's another outfall that I call "it's not my fault" syndrome. If evolution's true, we're just the product of random processes, then how can we be blamed for anything that we do? One example is homosexuality. They call it sexual orientation because the implication is they're born that way. They're just products of evolution. It's not their fault. Therefore, laws need to be changed to accommodate that lifestyle. In fact, they point out that some of the higher animals have been observed to engage in sort of homosexual activity, and therefore, since we're just a little bit higher on the evolutionary ladder, then it's totally excusable because evolution is true. In fact, in 1981, the Kinsey Institute issued a report claiming that homosexuality was inherited. Have you ever seen or heard that radio ad that says alcoholism is just bad genes? After all, you know, it's just your heredity. You're not responsible for it, so nobody can blame you. In fact, this kind of thinking has found its way into criminology. Apparently, natural selection hasn't weeded out bad behavior yet. But as a matter of fact, one author says, violence then is natural to man, a product of evolution. So you see, in the struggle for existence, the survival of the fittest, the most violent people are the ones that survive, right? Therefore, violence is natural, and somehow we've got to put up with it, I guess. But there's kind of a widespread idea that criminals aren't really responsible for their actions because it's nature's fault due to bad genes. In fact, a whole school of thought has come up treating criminals as genetically retarded. That is, going, they're throwbacks to earlier stages of evolution, and therefore they're not really responsible for their actions. And some of the punishments given out, I think, reflect that. Well, how about environmentalism and evolution? Did you suspect that there's a link there? Well, you're right. If God is not the creator, but we all come from stardust, then we owe our allegiance not to God, but our mother, that is, Earth, right? Well, the worship of the environment by some of these people amounts to a religion of pantheism. As I mentioned earlier, the earth being a kind of a god to be worshipped. This is all based on evolution. And as a matter of fact, some of the more extreme earth worshippers have turned to what they call the Gaia hypothesis. The Gaia hypothesis says the earth and its ecosystems are part of a living entity. It's a living system that needs to be worshipped, revered. In fact, we could even say some things about global warming and evolution. Now, let me say right off that global warming is probably real, at least within a certain time frame, certain reference of time. But with Genesis discredited, people look increasingly to government to solve the problem. So the hysteria is, oh, we've got to pass laws to take care of global warming. Man becomes responsible. Now, maybe we are to a certain degree, but I think that's highly disputable. The view, however, seems to be that the Earth atmosphere, having evolved, is very fragile, and it's really easy to upset it. There's a good illustration to that in chaos theory. Chaos theory says that a small change or perturbation in one place can lead to larger unintended consequences. And the usual illustration that they give is the butterfly effect. The butterfly effect says that a butterfly flapping its wings in China can, over time, produce a tornado in Kansas or a heat wave in New York City or something. I guess there must have been a butterfly at some point, judging from the heat in New York that I've been hearing about. But anyway, that chaos theory is interesting. It's a mathematical concept, but it's never been shown to have any application in nature. Nobody's ever devised any experiments to prove it. So I don't think it applies here. But rather than being in such a delicate balance, I, as a meteorologist, view the Earth atmosphere system as much more robust than some of these people think it is. Well, again, this reminds me of Romans 1:25, where it says they exchanged the truth of God for a lie. The Greek is the lie, and worshipped and served created things rather than the Creator, who is forever praised. What is the lie? Well, the lie harkens back to Genesis, where Satan said to Adam and Eve, "You shall be as gods." This lie is humanism with evolutionism as its platform. Well, we've seen a few examples of the effects of evolutionism in our society. I don't have time to go on and talk about things like the effect of evolution, how it's been the basis of social systems such as communism, fascism, Nazism. We could talk about racism, ethics, public education, the sexual revolution, and on and on and on. But I think you get the idea. The question is, what should be and what will be the basis of our thinking? Creation has given us a value of human life, marriage, sound science, morality, law, family values. Naturalism and materialism with its offspring, Darwinism, is eroding all of that, giving us atheism, lawlessness, moral relativism, flawed science, redefining marriage, devaluing human life. Dr. Henry Morris said, "Evolution is not merely a biological theory of little significance. It's a worldview. The worldview diametrically opposing the Christian worldview. Therefore, Christians ignore it or compromise with it at great peril." In fact, even evolutionists recognize this. Michael Ruth said, "Evolution is a full-fledged alternative to Christianity." In other words, what he's applying is evolution is in itself a religion. What constitutes a religion? Well, first you need a set of beliefs, like materialism and naturalism. And you need some holy writings. Well, we've got Darwin's Origin of Species. And we need a prophet. Darwin will do just fine. And there should be a promise of reward to the faithful. The promise of humanism is sexual freedom, a humanistic utopia here on earth. A religion requires faith. Well, in this case, in the case of evolution, it's faith in the power of random processes, faith in the power of chance. And finally, a religion involves proselytizing. Well, the media and the universities and even the government are doing a great job of that. In fact, it takes faith. It takes a lot of faith to believe that a cosmic egg suddenly materialized out of nowhere and caused the Big Bang. It takes faith to believe that evolution happened in spite of impossible odds. It takes faith to believe that evolution somehow circumvented the second law of thermodynamics. It takes faith to believe that the creation has the appearance of being designed, but there was no designer. And finally, it takes faith to believe that conditions just happen to be right by pure chance for life to be just right, for conditions to be just right for life to evolve on Earth. And so we see evolution really is a religion. It fits all the criteria. In fact, it takes a lot of faith to be an evolutionist, more faith to be an evolutionist than a creationist, because evolutionists must believe that somehow everything created itself out of nothing and for no apparent reason. Well, so in wrapping up tonight, I've painted a rather bleak picture of our society. But where does that leave us today? In contrast to the materialistic view of Darwinism, Christianity, I maintain, is the only worldview big enough to explain everything. That is because materialism, Darwinism, starts out with something less than an infinite creator. The problem is that humanism isn't just something that a few intellectuals believe, but unfortunately, it's become the unofficial state religion of the United States in this post-Christian society. It's taught in the classroom and it's upheld by the courts. So what can we do about it? Well, I think we need to go back to Deuteronomy chapter 4, verses 9 and 10, where God places the responsibility on us, who are parents, to carry the teaching forward that God is creator. He said, teach them, and what he was referring to was the things that they heard, the Israelites heard on Mount Horeb. Teach them to your children and to their children after them. And I might add, not only to our children, but to whomever we have the opportunity to share with. I think part of this responsibility, a good part, involves showing them, our children, how God is the creator and the fallaciousness of the religion of evolution, that they might not be swayed when they are faced with evolutionary thought in the universities and in the media. That's all I have to say tonight. I hope this has helped you some.